abandonment. I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone. My soul leaped up when he spoke. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. Song of Solomon 5 verse 6. Is there something like spiritual abandonment? There are those who at all times are convinced of it and speak about it. There are also those who most certainly deny its existence. The people of the first group who so easily talk about it are inclined to say, in all kinds of circumstances, and in their own life, which is empty of good works and bare and dry in the fear of the Lord, that this can be explained by a spiritual abandonment. They imagine reality to be thus. When it pleases God to give them His blessing and enter into fellowship with them, He indeed will give them the fullness of His blessing as a refreshing dew upon their life, and work the fruits in them. But if it does not please God to do thus, then the consequence of His sovereign work, of His withdrawing hand, appear immediately in their dry and withered poor souls. They will then feel lonely and will be able to do nothing about it. Perhaps they are not even spiritual enough for that feeling of loneliness. They simply are dead and dry, and that is it. God has forsaken them. They will remain in that spiritual abandonment until it pleases God to break that state of depression by returning to them. They are quick to quote big words from the great prophets, who indeed have complained so often in this way about their forsakenness by God. And they do not ask what kind of revelation, historical context, those prophetic or lyrical groans of the soul entailed, and should be considered, in order to understand them. Because of this, others will say, "Wait a moment, it is not that easy. You should not compare yourself so quickly to the great heroes in the battles of the Lord and to their victories. You should not just transfer the soul conflicts of A. David, an Isaiah, A. Moses, or A. Jeremiah to the experiences of ordinary citizens of today. For," and now they reason psychologically, "the one soul is not the other. And when a great man, a hero, a mighty warrior before the face of the Lord, portrays the conflicts of his soul in the thunderous language of Eastern life and Eastern color, and then speaks of God's abandonment, a dwarf of today should not apply that so quickly to the ups and downs in his own soul." What should we say of these things? We will not go along with either of these groups. For against the latter group, we have this objection. They want to reason psychologically about the work of God and simply make their decisions according to the possibilities of what is or what is not His work. The question as to what God can or cannot do is not a matter of psychology, but of revelation faith. But against that other group, that first one, we also have our objections. For they are inclined to accuse God of the deadness, the dryness of man. On this point, they break the commonly acknowledged rule of the connection of God's work and ours. And thus they quell our conscience by self-willed passivity, or by a false theology, by considering the sin of a covenant child to be the rule, and grace to be the odd exception, thus quelling the complaint, the charge, that God sometimes raises against His people when they forsake Him. By these last words, our hand is putting the key into the lock of this practical problem of faith. When does God forsake us in the covenant? He does that only when we forsake Him. Outside the covenant, Pharaoh was not hardened, if he had not himself hardened. And in that covenant, nobody is forsaken by God without he himself forsaking God. Was the bride in the Song of Solomon such a valiant hero, such a giant, such an extraordinary person as David, Moses, or Jeremiah? No. In the comparison, she was portrayed as a plain and ordinary bride of low descent, of little people. And in the end, she does not represent an elite one of God's people, but all of God's people. And listen once to what she dreamt and how she dreamt. She dreamt that her bridegroom, who in the meantime had lawfully become her own, asked to be received by her. And she dreamt further that she gave him the answer that this time it was indeed too great an effort for her to receive him. She said to him, even though it was with hesitation, "I rather not do it this time." By day she was amazed that he wanted to belong to her and would only say yes to his love. But in her dream, it indeed happened that she disregarded the miracle of his love and said no to the one who was entitled to her love. And after that, no sooner had she expressed her unwillingness of a moment, and he, who indeed was not interested in entering her chamber upon any other than a voluntary basis, for there was a covenant, left and abandoned her. And she, now reacting quickly, jumped up and wanted to invite him in, but saw that he was gone. That now was her abandonment, a comparison, if you will, of spiritual abandonment. But she had left him first from her side and violated the terms of the covenant of marriage. One can understand the Song of Solomon in different ways. But nobody will deny that in this parable, the spirit of love is speaking continually about his and her histories. Thus, this fine detail of the parable illustrates the reality of spiritual abandonment. It always accuses us. For there is not one included in this covenant who, when he is abandoned, has not abandoned first himself. This is for the first group. And nobody in the large circle of the covenant community can escape this general rule of the covenant, that all hesitancy and all guilt have their consequences, because every sin, already by the loss of spiritual fruit and the decrease of obedience, automatically causes an abandonment, which is attributed to us as far as it concerns guilt, and moreover in regards to God, does not happen outside of his control. That is against the second group. And he who judges in this way, according to the scriptures, does not exclude God from the process of spiritual abandonment. But neither will he exclude himself. He will accuse himself and never God, who will again accept him, also in his own consciousness, as soon as the charge against ourselves has been spoken into the ears of God. A smart theologian who understands the terminology will object that a parable or comparison is but a parable. It is anthropomorphic, the speaking about God in a human manner. He is perfectly right, but he is also perfectly wrong. For all of God's revelation is anthropomorphic. Only thus it addresses us in our concrete situations.